Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm Eli Koaz. We are 5 days away from the third round of Israeli elections, and this is going to be our pre-elections special podcast, and I'm happy to be joined in studio in Tel Aviv with Israeli political guru Neri Zilber. Neri is an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute, and he's research director of BICOM. He's been published in hundreds of publications. Hundreds? Is it hundreds?
I would go with dozens.
Dozens, okay. So dozens of publications. He is a Manchester United fan.
True story.
I won't hold that against him, but he's joining me now. Neri, how's it going?
Doing well, despite the impending election. But thank you for having me back.
Always a pleasure. So maybe let's start with just the state of the race at the moment. The polls indicate that Netanyahu, whose Likud party has been trailing for most of this campaign, is now, I don't know if we can say surging, but they've crept ahead of Kahol Lavan in all of the polls. It hasn't really changed the situation with the blocs. But how do you rate the state of play at the moment?
Well, I think to go to your second point first, big picture, we're still likely looking at paralysis after next Monday, after Election Day. Neither Gantz nor Netanyahu are likely to have enough seats to form some kind of governing coalition. The right-wing bloc loyal to Netanyahu and will likely remain so. The quote-unquote center-left bloc will likely remain with Gantz, but they're not likely to have enough seats, maybe not even for a minority government, and we can get into the various scenarios in a minute. That's big picture. Small picture, you're right. It seems like Netanyahu initially was holding in the polls, and that in and of itself, I would argue, was an accomplishment, especially coming out of the formal indictments that were filed in court a few weeks ago, coming out of the late November decision by Attorney General Mandelblit to indict Netanyahu on various charges, including bribery. So in and of itself, that was an accomplishment for Netanyahu. What he's done in the past month, I would argue, is even more impressive. He's dominated the news cycle. He's dominated the agenda almost on a daily basis, with little assist from President Trump a month ago with the release of the Deal of the Century. But not only, and through this domination of the agenda and the news cycle, he's actually improved his position. And as you mentioned, in recent polls, they've actually crept ahead of Blue and White, I would say, for the first time in a year. So big picture, it might not change anything, but it is indicative. It is indicative of where things are headed come going into Election Day.
So let's maybe talk about Netanyahu's campaign for a second. He's always been known as maybe one of the top political campaigners in the world. But when those indictments were announced and became official, everybody thought, how is he going to get out of this? And as you mentioned, he's really controlled the agenda, beginning with the Trump peace plan announcement to now we have this scandal that has emerged kind of out of nowhere with Kahol Lavan and Benny Gantz and the fifth dimension, where Gantz isn't even a suspect, but somehow people are almost talking about the two situations with a sort of parody, which is kind of absurd and obviously what Netanyahu has been trying to do. How has Netanyahu really shaped the agenda completely?
So, right, Netanyahu, he's a very effective campaigner. This time especially, I think he learned the lessons from the last round, from the September election. So first step, I think what really helped him, even before the proper elections were called in December, you might remember that that there was a Likud primary challenge. Gideon Saar, a Likud former senior minister, challenged Netanyahu for the leadership of the party.
Feels like years ago.
Feels like years ago. In Israeli political terms, it was years ago, even though it was just in December. And Netanyahu, not only did he win, and he won convincingly, and he won, I think, by a greater margin than people expected. I think it was something like 70-something to 20-something, a really poor showing by Saar. So number one, it really solidified Netanyahu's position within the party. But number two, and perhaps more pertinently to the general election, Netanyahu campaigned on the ground, old school retail politics. He went to campaign events. He was shaking hands. He was kissing babies.
Well, not shaking hands anymore because of
coronavirus.
Coronavirus,
right?
If you saw in a visit to
Hebron,
to the tomb of the patriarchs,
right?
Because that was the place where there was a Korean group who had coronavirus. So the leaders of the community went to shake his hand, and he said namaste instead. Actually,
right? He said namaste. I think his wife was right there with him and explained that it was government orders. I think that's important because you can't run a country if you're quarantined. You can't run a country via Skype.
But you can run a country apparently while taking on three separate charges in a courtroom, or at least Netanyahu is where he is in the polls. It makes it seem that that's not a problem for a lot of Israeli
according
voters.
To some Netanyahu supporters and loyalists, that doesn't seem to be a problem. So yeah, coronavirus may be more important to them than indictment for bribery. But that aside, the December Likud primary challenge really reminded Netanyahu, I would say, that it is important to get out there. You can't run a campaign solely on social media, which is what he was really doing last summer ahead of the second round. So the light went off. And what you've seen, I think, in the past 2 or 3 months is Netanyahu really pressing the flesh, really getting out there, almost Trump-style rallies he's been holding almost every night. With supporters in the background standing on stage with him, him grabbing a mic, and he's kind of almost speaking extemporaneously off the cuff, and something that Netanyahu was very effective at doing, but he wasn't really doing that in the previous two rounds. So that in and of itself, I think, has helped him to show the public that he still has the support of his base. And number two, the mudslinging. The mudslinging has been effective. You mentioned the fifth dimension, the scandal surrounding Gantz, not to get too far into the weeds, but the acting state prosecutor, which was appointed by Netanyahu's acting justice minister, opened an investigation or announced the opening of an investigation last week. Very convenient timing. And regardless of whether people actually believe it to be true or not, Netanyahu is raising this kind of comparison. Well, everybody's corrupt. Everybody's the same. And that plays into a certain level of distrust that exists anyway among the Israeli public towards the political class. So that helps Netanyahu. It dilutes the impact, I would say, of his own corruption indictments, his own official corruption indictments. And then I think the third and perhaps most important factor was really this domination of the news agenda. So we saw it a month ago, the White House visit, the release of the Trump peace plan, the quote-unquote deal of the century for Israel and the Palestinians. That came on the same day, and it's not a coincidence, but that came on the same day that Netanyahu pulled his own request for parliamentary immunity. And that kind of pushed the immunity request off the front pages. And then onwards and upwards. There was a trip to Moscow. He secured the release of an Israeli backpacker. There was a trip to Africa. He met with a Sudanese leader. There was the handling of the coronavirus. So he's been front and center with that.
He promised that Israel would find a cure,
right,
that he would open a special project, assuming that he would find the cure himself even? Or?
Not himself, but he's directing people to do this and to do that. That plays into the bigger picture issue, which I think is the real point. He's projecting business as usual. Mm-hmm. He's projecting that he's in control. He's running the affairs of the state, and you can agree or disagree with his decisions on various issues. But he is front and center. He is still has his hand on the wheel. And that, you know, includes things like announcing settlement constructions in East Jerusalem and the West Bank.
It announces, and E1, which was a major announcement. I mean, we can maybe touch on that
right
later. That was an announcement yesterday to build in a controversial area that is really the only place where the West Bank could connect with East Jerusalem.
Right. So that would likely forestall any contiguous Palestinian state. There was also the announcement of construction in a fairly controversial Eastern Jerusalem neighborhood that would also kind of forestall any kind of real capital for a future Palestinian state in East Jerusalem. So that's, you know, kind of goodies being sent out for his right-wing base, for the settlers. I call it the Oprah doctrine. You know, you get a car. So he's giving goodies away to the settlers. He's even campaigning, trying to target Arab Israelis. I don't even think he believes he can win their votes, but it's also meant to depress Arab
Depress Israeli. The voter turnout, yeah, which is a concern of his.
Right.
Kind of backfired in the second round of elections because his campaign was targeting really not just Arab Knesset members, targeting Arab Israelis in general, and it led to voter turnout being significantly higher than at least the first round of elections where there was a voter turnout was very low in Arab communities.
Right. So he wants to hopefully depress that demographic to get less people excited to come out and to vote. You know, he sent a few senior ministers to Ethiopia to bring back a few dozen Ethiopian Jews. Again, so on and so forth. Business as usual. I am still the prime minister. I want to remain prime minister, despite the challenge from Benny Gantz and Blue and White, and despite the legal challenge from the court coming up.
So you mentioned this trip to Ethiopia, and that kind of relates to something else that I wanted to touch on. Netanyahu, even if he wins this election and the Likud win the most amount of seats, that's not enough. He needs to get to 61 seats if he really wants to secure himself as prime minister for the foreseeable future, maybe pass some sort of immunity law. There's been discussion about a French law. So to do that, he realizes, I think, that he needs to get voters that are soft right voters that are in between Kahol Lavan and Likud and Lieberman, two or three seats there. That's one thing that he has to do if he wants to have any chance at reaching 61. So what I've noticed in his campaign is a special focus on the Ethiopian community, something that was completely neglected by him almost in the last round of elections. We saw him kind of did a sneaky getting Gadi Yavarkan
to defect
from Blue and White to Likud, a leader in the Ethiopian community. He's done very prominent rallies with Ethiopian community members. We're talking about a community of about 150,000 people in Israel, maybe 80,000 voters. Still, that's 2 to 3 seats in the Knesset. So just he's really focusing on the margins, besides talking to his base, which is one thing, but he's also really trying to see where he can get votes from. Another thing that I think is going to be very important for him if he wants any chance of getting to 61 is to see if he can manage to get the far-right Jewish Strength Party to somehow make some announcement that they're not running anymore, to try to get that, I think they're at about 1.6%, to get those votes to actually count towards the right-wing bloc. Talk about maybe his chances. Don't give me any predictions. I don't want any predictions.
I'm out of the
prediction. I know you're
business.
Out of that business. But is it realistic for him to even think about getting 61 seats?
It is, and I'll tell you why. In April, so two elections ago, he was about 1,400 or 1,500 votes out of 1 million, 2 million, 3 million cast from actually getting a 61-seat majority. That didn't happen. Naftali Bennett and the Ayala Shaked's party didn't pass the threshold back then, and Lieberman defected from the right-wing bloc, and here we are today, almost a year later. So the real question is whether the election come Monday will look a lot more like April or a lot more like September, where he really lost something between 7 to 10 seats, all told, from the right wing. He even says it in his campaign platform now, 300,000 right-wing voters that didn't show up to the polls in September. And that was really the story of September. Where did all the right-wing votes go? A lot of them just stayed home. So he's banking on the fact that it looks a lot more like April. If that doesn't happen, then, as you mentioned, he's looking for every additional vote that he can find, anywhere he can find it. Ethiopian Israelis, obviously Russian Israelis, soft right-wing voters, hard-line right-wing voters. So Jewish Power, the party that you mentioned, isn't expected to pass the threshold. And there's been a lot of pressure on the party leader, Itamar Ben-Gvir, this far-right Kahanist supporter, to drop out. He's refused. Now, whether he remains consistent until Monday, that's an open question. But that could be at least two seats from the right-wing bloc that go down the drain. And that's important to Netanyahu, precisely to get to the 61-seat majority. But barring all that, Netanyahu, like the previous round, is at the very least hoping for a tie. In other words, he might not have a governing coalition, but he's sure as hell not going to allow Benny Gantz to have any shot at forming a realistic governing coalition. And that's one hope of his. The other hope of his has more to do with the post-election politics, to keep both the Likud and his right-wing allies loyal. There are no defections to blue and white. There's no palace coup within the Likud. As of now, and just based on the polls and based on the fact that Netanyahu is still relatively strong, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, and another option, which could help him get to 61, is if he's close, if he's at that 59-60 range, you could technically convince one or two MKs to defect to join the coalition. People have been talking about that recently. You have some right-wing MKs in Kahol Levan, Yoaz Hendel and Zvi Hauser, kind of in a Gadi Yevarkan kind of style a move. Is that possible?
Look, anything's possible because it's Israeli politics. So you can say something one day and then completely flip the next day. Gadi Yevarkan is on record publicly in television interviews blasting Netanyahu a few months ago. And then he obviously flipped afterwards. So anything is possible, but I deem it unlikely because all the players have gotten this far, and it would, I think, reflect badly on them in future, especially for someone like Zvi Hauser and Yoaz Hendel, who really have...
They're more the same. I mean, to not discredit Gadi Yevarkan, they are more like, kind of, more, I don't know if accomplished, but they're more like, I think they have more of a reputation that they want to kind of...
I think so.
Hold on to.
I think more of a reputation... Again, it took a lot for them to actually do what they've done, which is essentially leave the Likud, campaign against the Likud prime minister, campaign against their natural political constituency. So all told, this is really the main reason why a lot of analysts here are looking at a possible fourth election, God forbid.
Let's talk about that a bit, or maybe talk about the man himself who can prevent the fourth election, and who has promised to prevent the fourth election, Avigdor Lieberman. Avigdor Lieberman, I think he made this promise actually before the third election as well, that there wouldn't be third elections. But he's been almost campaigning that there won't be fourth elections. And just today, that he wouldn't join a government that is enabled by the abstention of the Arab parties. But at the same time, Lieberman has said during this campaign that Netanyahu's era is over, and he has signaled that he is leaning towards Gantz and joining a Gantz coalition. What are his considerations here? Can he afford another round of elections? I know that he loves the attention. I don't think there's anybody that would argue with that. Him being the center of attention could be the most important thing for him, and he doesn't want to lose that, and he will probably be the kingmaker. That's what all the polls are indicating. What do we rate? Not asking for a prediction, but is it likely that he picks a side?
I think it's likely that he's already picked a side. He's made it very clear in recent weeks that he's likely to recommend Gantz. He's come out publicly and said Netanyahu will not remain prime minister. Netanyahu is at the end of his road. Kind of very direct, very blunt statements coming from Lieberman, which he hadn't said previously. But you're right. Lieberman, over the past year, has been the kingmaker of any potential government. What he said in recent weeks is just confusing because he doesn't want to go with Netanyahu. He doesn't want to sit with the ultra-Orthodox, which he vehemently disagrees with about issues of religion and state. He refuses, as you mentioned, to receive any kind of support, whether by commission or omission, from the Arab parties. So not too much is left. And the numbers, just based on the polls, likely won't allow for any kind of constellation that Lieberman can support. So I'm not quite clear what Lieberman wants from us.
Attention, I think. I mean,
attention, but as you said, he's come out and also said there won't be a fourth election. So what are you actually promising us? It's unclear. But again, given that it's Israeli politics and given the fact that there is going to be an election on Monday, coronavirus notwithstanding, we'll all have to kind of look at how the numbers shake out and what the potential constellations are. And then I think us and primarily the politicians will actually have to make kind of chart a new course. But as it stands now, Lieberman will be the kingmaker, but the kingmaker of what?
We'll have to wait and see. Let's talk a bit about Kahol Levan. We mentioned how Netanyahu was able to control the agenda completely. And I think that Benny Gantz and company and the cockpit, as they're called, have tried to make this election about one thing, Netanyahu's criminal indictments and that he is unfit to be prime minister while being in court. He can't be in court during the day and then run the country at night. And all of their ads have been based on that. All of their messaging has been focused on that. But it hasn't really worked. Now they're in a position where we, the last few days of the campaign, Netanyahu, I think himself, likes to be behind by a seat or two right before the last few days of the election so he can do what's called his signature Gewalt campaign, where he goes around the country saying that the right-wing government is in danger, the left and the Arabs
are about to take power.
Take power, exactly.
The sky is falling.
Exactly. Can Gantz and Kahol Levan use this kind of drop to their advantage? And do you see kind of a, almost like a reverse scenario here where Kahol Levan really have an opportunity to kind of surge in the last few days? And what would you recommend like that they do, or what are they missing so far from the campaign?
I'll tackle that in a few sections, right? As an Israeli journalist tweeted out this morning, he says, you know, somebody should fly a plane over Tel Aviv and drop some Prozac on the city because everyone's walking around very depressed, precisely because of the poll numbers and the fact that blue and white are now potentially behind relative to the Likud. But I think your point is well taken, that it could help them drive out turnout, and turnout writ large will be crucial. Who actually gets their voter base out on Monday to vote, despite the apathy, despite the third round, despite the potential fourth round? Voter turnout, who actually comes and votes? So it could help them. It could help them kind of focus minds, and you're already seeing it. You're already seeing them kind of shift gears a little bit, get a bit more, shall I say, hysterical, comparing Netanyahu to Erdogan, raising the vision of Netanyahu getting to 61 seats, getting a governing coalition and turning this place into Turkey. Now, I'm not quite sure that's likely, but it focuses minds again. So that might help them in terms of their own voter turnout. To your second point, what kind of campaign have they run? Very similar to campaign to what they ran in the summer, which was very defensive, very simple message. We're not Netanyahu, we're not Bibi. His time is over, now it's our time. Very little policy differences that they've emphasized relative to Netanyahu. So you can argue that that's a smart campaign to try to kind of siphon off soft right-wing voters, although many people are skeptical that it's actually working. So, you know, we'll have to see how things shake out on Monday. But we could have been sitting here before the election in September and kind of criticized them for the type of campaign that they ran back then. And it turned out to actually succeed for them in September. Now, maybe perhaps a bit more apathy. Gantz himself, I've been following Gantz since his first speech in politics, even before Blue and White was created. It almost seems like he's kind of regressing as a public political figure. His public statements are a little less sharp than they were last summer. His interviews are a bit less focused. Now, will that sway enough voters away from Blue and White? I don't know. The anti-Netanyahu sentiment is still quite strong. But Blue and White haven't run the greatest campaign. And I think this kind of hedge towards the right might ultimately backfire, because their voter base primarily is center-left and left-wing voters who are just fed up with kind of a decade plus of Netanyahu.
And that's also another question. Will they go to this Amir Peretz and Labor Meretz Gesher, try to get votes from there, because we've seen in the polls that that's where they've lost some of their one or two seats, because we've seen actually Labor Meretz Gesher rise to about 10 seats. But what does it do for them at the end of the day if they get two or three seats off of Labor, which becomes a party with six or seven seats? The size of the blocks doesn't change. And that's an argument that has been made in round one and round two by Kahol Levan, that if they're the biggest party, they'll be able to form a government.
Faulty logic.
Right.
So it's been proven incorrect twice.
Exactly. And Yair Lapid has started yesterday trying to make that case that you shouldn't vote Labor Party, because if Kahol Levan's not the biggest party, they won't form a government. I assume that people wouldn't be listening anymore. But we've seen that as election day approaches, there is this kind of votes move to the larger parties. And on top of that, this election, we don't have any parties really. I'm not going to count Otzma Yehudit and Jewish Strength. We don't have any parties that are in jeopardy of falling under the threshold. We have a smaller number of parties running in this election. So do you think there's going to be a similar like surge?
I think there might be a slight surge. But again, I think really the voter turnout will be crucial. So it's not only votes shifting from one party to the next. I think it's the total number of votes. Can you retain your voters from September? So blue and white, perhaps, but perhaps not. Perhaps there is a kind of growing apathy among their voter base, and really turning out new voters who perhaps didn't vote in September. And we're not quite seeing that either. So all in all, your point is well taken, right? They've been the largest party, or at least tied with Likud in April, twice already, and it didn't help them either to form a government, or more importantly, to pressure certain right-wing parties to break from Netanyahu and the Likud. It didn't help them twice before. I'm not entirely convinced it'll help them this time either. So really, the size of the blocks are what matters. And I'd go even further. What really matters is how close blue and white and Labor, Gesher, Meretz, and Lieberman together get to Netanyahu's right-wing bloc. So you're looking at the numbers for each bloc respectively, and how close blue and white and their allies can come to that number. Last time, I think the difference was 55-52. So if you believe the polls right now, that gap has widened, which doesn't help blue and white, even with the perhaps more realistic scenario of forming a minority government. Because last time they had this option as well, they didn't want to accept the support of the Arab-Israeli parties. So if the gap is quite small, or even if they overtake, blue and white overtake the right-wing bloc, then you don't even need the active support of the Arab-Israeli parties. You need them just to abstain. That's, I think, an easier political lift for people like Lieberman, for people like Yoaz Hendel or Tzvi Hauser. Absent that, maybe another election.
So you mentioned the Arab parties. So let's talk about the joint list for a minute. Something unprecedented happened after last election, which was they recommended Gantz, the joint list, or at least three quarters of the joint list recommended Gantz to be as their candidate for prime minister, something that had never happened before. Ayman Ode, the head of the joint list, is promising 16 seats.
He's optimistic.
But let's talk about their role and what you see. I think they've actually run a pretty effective campaign. But at the same time, their campaign, it seems like it depends a lot on how much they're targeted actually by Netanyahu. And that is what kind of gave many Arabs who didn't vote in the first round kind of the impetus to go out and vote in the second round. Do you see that momentum there? And how important is their voter turnout in the end picture here?
I think Arab-Israeli voter turnout will be crucial. So we talk about Lieberman as the kingmaker. I think arguably the real kingmakers are the Arab-Israeli citizens of Israel. If they come out and vote in large numbers, not only will that give the joint list their own kind of natural parties, more seats and more leverage, any kind of future governing coalition, any kind of future makeup of the Knesset. But it will dilute, relatively speaking, other parties' strength in the next Knesset. So you can envision a scenario where the Joint Arab List increases in strength, and certain other parties decrease in strength, and then, relatively speaking, Gantz might have an easier path if you were willing to accept their support. Again, that's a very tricky political question for blue and white. Underlying all of it is a real structural problem, right? You look at the polls that the Israeli news channels and newspapers put out, and they have this thing called the right-wing bloc, which is easy enough to understand. Netanyahu's Likud, the settler parties, and the two ultra-Orthodox parties. That's the right-wing bloc. Easy peasy. And then they have something called the center-left bloc, right, which is blue and white, and then Labor, Gesher, Meretz. And then they add the Arab parties, the Joint List, to that center-left bloc. That animal doesn't exist. Doesn't exist because blue and white isn't politically willing to accept that support. And then obviously you have Lieberman as this kind of kingmaker. I think it's more accurate to say that there's a center-left Lieberman bloc, and then the Arab-Israeli, the Joint List, is kind of out there and nobody really wants to touch it. And that's the real structural problem for the Israeli left. Because blue and white and this kind of the center-left Lieberman bloc only gets to about 50 seats relative to the right-wing bloc, which is about 55, 57 seats. So that gap structurally can only be made up by the Arab-Israeli citizens of Israel.
If we're talking about voter turnout, which is obviously going to be key here, I have a theory. Do you want to hear it?
Of course. I love theories.
Okay. So I have a theory that I'm not giving credit to coronavirus here, but a lot of Israelis are canceling trips that they've made. See, you haven't thought about this theory yet.
Okay.
So a lot of Israelis are canceling trips that they've made, that they've planned out for during this almost long weekend. Which is also something that hasn't existed before because traditionally elections are on Tuesday. So there's a long weekend. Vacations have been canceled by many Israelis. I don't know if this has the potential to actually change voter turnout. And I'm gonna say, and this is obviously speculation, that a lot of the people canceling vacations are not ultra-Orthodox Israeli voters, and they're more toward Kahol Lavan area of
North Tel Aviv.
Thereabouts. Exactly. So do you think coronavirus has the potential to maybe make this, out of all of the three elections, the highest voter turnout of all?
I wouldn't say that. I think apathy outweighs a respiratory virus.
And this is a two-sided coin, because it could be that coronavirus actually
depresses turnout. People don't. Look, I think, all kidding aside, I think Israel is not quite there yet. But will there be an issue of certain people just staying home and saying, okay, they're all the same. I don't trust any of the politicians, and this goes back to Netanyahu's recent campaign trying to tar Gantz as corrupt as he is, Gabi Ashkenazi as corrupt as they are. And so on and so forth. They're all the same. We don't trust anybody. It doesn't really matter. And there's going to be a fourth election anyway. I think that more than the coronavirus could depress voter turnout. And then we might get some very weird numbers that we haven't seen in the previous two rounds.
But I mean, by all accounts, it looks like there's going to be, or like at least we're headed toward the path of fourth elections.
Perhaps, but I think even the fact that we're talking about it, and then, Israeli analysts and news anchors talk about it openly, they joke about it, I think that in and of itself could have an impact, arguably more to the benefit of the right wing. Because as we know, certain, let's say, ultra-Orthodox parties or the religious nationalist, the settler parties, one word from a rabbi and people go out and vote. So I think their turnout will likely remain strong relative to, let's say, the North Tel Aviv kind of center-left, left-wing crowd. But it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So we're all talking about a fourth election. We're kidding about it, but not really kidding. One thing we haven't talked about, and this goes back to the issue of of how strong Netanyahu comes out of Election Day. Is 2 weeks after Election Day, next Monday on
March 17th.
March 17th is this potential start of Netanyahu's corruption trial. Before that happens, the Supreme Court will have to weigh in, most likely, about whether Netanyahu is even legally able to get the mandate to form a government and to be a future prime minister. Now, this is an easy decision for the Supreme Court and for the Attorney General to make under any circumstance. But if Netanyahu, let's say, remains strong, and let's say he's even in the lead in terms of the numbers after Election Day, then would the justices and would the Attorney General actually have the stomach to disqualify Netanyahu? And that speaks to the legal and the political actually melding into each other, irrespective of how the blocks come out, irrespective of voter turnout. And that's also something to keep in mind. The legal process is only getting started.
So yeah, March 17th, definitely a crucial day. I want to ask you one more thing about Netanyahu and his voter base. I want to talk about Israelis in the South, because we just had what's become, unfortunately, the traditional pre-election skirmish with Hamas, a round of violence where we have rockets falling on Israeli cities in the South, and we have Israel responding, targeting Islamic Jihad and Hamas targets in Gaza. And it seems like a ceasefire has been reached and is in place, and we're back to quiet for maybe until the fourth election. Yeah. So Netanyahu, his base, which this is also something that's very interesting. If we look at consistent in second elections, first elections, Netanyahu wins by a huge majority in cities that are affected by Hamas rocket fire, from Beersheba to Ashkelon, to Ashdod, Netivot, Sderot, all these places, he wins convincingly, despite this happening again and again.
Only Bibi.
And despite the fact that you have people like, you have Amir Peretz, who, for example, the head of Labor Party, was mayor of Sderot, comes from Sderot.
He lives in Sderot still.
I think that in the last election, he only got 10 to 15% of the vote. But do you see any reason for this to change, or are we going to just see that consistent support for Netanyahu as always, despite rocket fire happening in just last week?
Right. I don't foresee it changing. I think there are deep cultural, demographic, socioeconomic reasons for all these voters to consistently vote Likud, despite the fact that Likud government in power over the past decade has kind of reigned over this deteriorating situation in the Gaza Strip and ongoing rocket fire, especially over the past 2 years. I don't foresee it changing. There was, in the midst of the escalation a few days ago, there was a reporter on Channel 12 reporting from, I believe it was Sderot. And towards the end of his stand-up interview and report from the field, a local started clanning around behind him. And then at a certain point, leaned into the microphone and yelled. What did he yell?
Ach, Bibi?
Only Bibi. And this is while red alerts are going off and in the middle of an escalation. So I think there are deep kind of cultural ties to the Likud, to Netanyahu himself as a political figure. You know, it's the same reason why in America they write books about, you know, what's the problem with Kansas? Why people oftentimes vote against their perceived immediate self-interest.
So we're wrapping up here. I'm not going to ask you for predictions.
Out of the prediction business. Retire.
Out of the business. But what I just want to know, what are you going to be looking for in the last few days of the campaign and on election day? I mean, we talked about voter turnout, and we talked especially in among Israeli Arabs. What are you focusing on?
So I think those two things are going to be the keys to how things go on election day. I think what I'll be looking for over the coming days is how blue and white respond to the decline in the polls that we've seen over the past week and a half. I think Netanyahu, we already know what he's going to say and do. He's kind of, based on the previous two rounds and then based on the last few weeks. He is able and willing to say anything, to garner votes, to blast his political rivals in very very kind of unsavory terms. I'm looking at how blue and right respond, whether they're able to focus their campaign to get out a clear message, to galvanize especially their base, and to explain to them why, while they weren't able to unseat Netanyahu in the previous two times, this time is just as important. And at the very least, they have to hold the line and hold the support, because otherwise, you know, what they've been saying, it's a bit hysterical, Erdogan, Erdogan, Erdogan. But Netanyahu, like I said, in April, he was only about 1,500 votes, rather, short of a 61-seat governing coalition. I'm not entirely convinced that's out of the cards.
Well, we'll have answers, not all the answers, but some answers on Monday night and Tuesday morning. But I feel like a lot will still be in the open, and we won't be that much smarter on Tuesday.
We'll at least have solid numbers to play around with. You know, it's the day after the election, and hopefully not the first day of the fourth election.
Amen to that. Well, Neri, Israeli political guru, thank you so much for sharing your insights and knowledge. And let's hope and pray that a fourth election is far, 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 far away, and that will happen in 4 to 5 years.
God willing. Thanks, Eli. Pleasure.
Thank you to everybody for tuning in. This week, Israel Policy Forum released a policy report examining and evaluating outcomes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in search of a viable option. The report is by Dr. Shira Efron and Evan Gottesman, a frequent host of this podcast, with a foreword by former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Daniel B. Shapiro. I encourage you all to check that out on Israel Policy Forum's website. And there will also be a podcast in the coming days with the authors of the study. Thank you very much, and we'll catch you next time.